Thank you very much. Dear President, dear distinguished panelists, and dear colleagues and my friends and the audience, first of all, I have to say thank you for this wonderful opportunity to participate in such a high level academic discussion. Thanks, you. Thanks, András. And I have to start with apologies. First of all, I'm not a media law expert at all, nor I'm not. I don't have so heavy interest in media at first, but my professional expertise is related to comparative law, with special regard to analyzing some aspects of certain legal cultures. And what I will try to do here is to provide you with an introduction to some interesting and not as famous features of the practice of the U.S. Supreme Court in the field of freedom of expression. I'm quite lucky in this situation because my paper is already in so I won't read it, but you will only find some cores of my intervention or presentation. So let's get started. Basically, what I was trying to clarify in this research is the question whether it's possible to identify the values behind certain quite famous and seminal decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. So in this case, I wasn't really interested in the legal side of these judgments, meaning the precise legal meaning. I'm sorry, but what was really interesting and important for me, there were some underlying values and how can we, I would say, identify or construct them. So, in my research, first of all, I have to tell you a few words, only a few of them, about the cases selected. When I successfully selected some important cases with the help of András, I really tried to deconstruct them from the point of view of argumentation. So I wasn't really interested in their normative saying, but what was really important at this point is how do the judges, or how do some parts of the cases argue, because I had the idea that if we regard these arguments and we regard the argumentation in a given case from the point of view of the sociology of values, we can somehow identify the values behind this argumentation. At the end, I think successfully I identified 8 values, and I also have some conclusions. So let me start with point one. Basically, the Supreme Court of the United States has an abundant practice and case law on freedom of expression. Therefore, I only went for the seminal cases. And because of that, I cannot argue that my analysis is a complete one. What I was trying to make is select some of the most important ones. And I think on the basis of these cases and on the basis of their deconstruction, is it possible to somehow approach the values being behind the general practice of the U.S. Supreme Court? So you can see here, I have started with Abrams, and I have ended with Hustler. So basically, I have started with a case from 1919, and then I ended somewhere close to the 90s. And as far as you can see, I had 8 cases to analyze. Basically, when I read through all these cases and with special regard to the argumentation, I had to conclude that 2 kinds of arguments can be more or less delimited or delineated. First of all, there are part of arguments which focus on how to ground the freedom of expression. I could call them the justificatory
arguments. Here we can find two points. Basically, one set of the arguments is related to the truth, being more special, related to the truth, to the prevalence of the truth via the free market of ideas and ideals. And the second set of arguments trying to justify the freedom of expression in these cases is connected to the right of the public to information. But what is interesting that there are four more sets of arguments in these cases. All of them grand for the limitation of freedom of expression. The first of these is the state of war. The second one is the denial of the absolute nature of freedom of speech. The third one, or point C, is the process of technological development. And the fourth one is the danger of clear and immediate illegal acts. But what is really interesting that even if these two parts of arguments seems to be separated from the point of view of, from a legal point, because the first part is about the justification, the second part is about the limitation. From the point of view of my analysis, trying to identify the values, trying to make a so-called sociology of values analysis, they are strictly connected because from all the arguments, we can have some impressions. How do judges think about the freedom of expression from the point of view of from a value-oriented point of view? Okay, so what I was doing, and you can read the details in my paper that was published in András's book, that if we deconstruct these six arguments, eight values appear, and first, let me start with the listing of the values, and then I will comment on them briefly. As you can, let me touch upon one methodological point. First of all, so in sociology of values, there's a common place that so-called expressed and hidden values should somehow be separated. A distinction should be made between them. And here, what is really interesting that these values are mostly expressed values, so I didn't focus on the hidden side of the values that may also appear in the argumentation. So there's a way for broader research, but in my case, that would be, for this paper, simply too much. And if we go for the expressed values in these cases, we can find eight of them. The first is truth. The second one is progress, being more precise, social and political progress. The third one is competition. The fourth is information. The fifth is public interest in general. The sixth is public peace. The seventh is adaptation to the changing circumstances. And the eighth one is protection of individuals. So my basic claim in my chapter is that if we deconstruct those cases that I have mentioned in the introduction, eight values can be identified as a value basis for the decisions of the Supreme Court's practice. Let me only give one example, because as far as I can see, I have still some time. So basically, one of the most classic, saying of the U.S. Supreme Court of the U.S. Supreme Court in the field of freedom of expression is the expression for the need of competition on the field of in the free market of ideas and ideals. And it's been formulated by Justice Holmes in the so-called famous Abrams case in 1919. And what is really interesting that here when Holmes formulated his claim for the truth as being the basis for the freedom of expression. He didn't only focus on the truth, but other values also appeared. Just listen to him. I will quote only one sentence. "But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting fates, they may come to believe that," I miss a part, "the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, and the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market, and that truth is the only ground upon which their wishes safely can be carried out." So basically what is interesting, that judges never relied on one value, but their work and their adjudication is determined, or had been, we would say in this case, determined by so-called value constellations and value universes. And it will lead to my conclusions too. So basically, in conclusion, I would summarize 4 points in more detail. First of all, I have to start the point I've already mentioned, that basically when judges try to fund or ground their argumentation, they have never referred simply to one value. But what they do, they refer to value universes. And it shed light on a very important dimension of values, that basically values never stay alone, but they are closely interrelated to each other, and they also interfere with each other many times. So when we try to identify the values being having some influence on the work of the judges, it's a very weak beginning if we start with the search of one given value, but what we have to do is to find or to identify some value universes, and these value universes had to be basically researched or studied. And let me have this example, what I have already quoted, that you can see that truth, progress, and competition in the argumentation in the Abrams case is closely interconnected, because basically Justice Holmes argues that truth can only appear through the competition of the ideas on a free market of the ideas, and the appearance or the evolvement of truth can lead to social and political progress. So because of that, basically I think what we have to always look up are these value universes. Secondly, it's also very interesting that normally we would suppose or we would think that when granting limitations for freedom of speech, individualistic argumentation or individualistic points may came to the forefront. But this is, having had this empirical analysis, simply untrue. What I have to realize, I'm really sorry, that basically the US Supreme Court has approached the problem of limitation of freedom of expression from a community-oriented point. So, it might be interesting, but the argumentation of the US Supreme Court that is related to the restriction of freedom of expression is mostly a communitarian one. Public peace, as for instance, or they've already referred to the state of war, to the national interest, and so on and so forth. And the individualist points have only a very limited role in that kind of argumentation. And this is very interesting because here in my country, and I've already told you that I'm not an expert of media law at all, but I have the impression, this is the proper term, that the policy questions of media regulations are mostly approached from the point of view of an individualistic dimension. So it was just revelatory for me. And the last point what I have to discuss in brief is the fact that if we try to put these values into a historical context. As for instance, there's a very famous French author named Rudolf Regelhazy, who already published two books on the historical development of European values. The striking point here is that these values, or I mean most of them, can easily be, or can be, I would say, I'm sorry, can be related to the value basis or the value universe of the Enlightenment. And I happily heard that Professor Weaver also referred to the pivotal role or to the determining role of the ideas of Enlightenment in the evolvement or in the development of the media regulation. And it's empirically also justified because 7 from these 8 values, truth is a universal value, it comes from the Greek era, is clearly has some relation to the Enlightenment, meaning that it's been evolved and it's been really developed as a part of the public discourse from the 17th to the 19th century. So that's also very interesting that there's some kind of judicial, or I would say, theoretical transfer between the two sides of the continent, that in these times we have already learned a lot from the experiences of the US freedom of expression regulations and the attitude from the United States toward the freedom of expression. But at the beginning, we also gave something from the US, basically those values that form a basis for the argumentation of the justices of the US Supreme Court. So all in all, as far as I can see, I have a few more minutes to conclude. At the very beginning, let me start with a confession. At the very beginning, when András requested me or asked me very kindly to participate in the work of this group, I wasn't sure whether I can come up with anything new or whether I can come up with something academically relevant information, because as I told you, I'm not a media law expert. But having had these studies and having written this chapter, I had to conclude in myself that basically my research is had some sense, because that kind of analysis of the US Supreme Court judgments, which were focused on their literary sides and not on their normative relevance, basically learned me that values are extremely important in all over the in the all dimensions of media law, even in the argumentation of the judges. So I have only a last sentence. Thank you for your kind and attentive hearing.